Chapter 5.
Shit!
Dave groaned, looking at the soldiers around him. Is anybody getting a signal other than helmet-to-helmet laser link stuff? All the replies came back negative. Most people just shook their heads. Jates kept low, walking over to Dave and taking a knee next to him so they could talk quietly. Their helmet faceplates swung open.
Suggestions, Chica? We're exposed and outnumbered out here.
The big lizard swiveled his head side to side to scan the sky above. He nodded to where Lieutenant Colonel Strebick was reviewing their meager collection of supplies.
The Colonel wants options.
With all of the infantry company's officers dead, or presumed dead, Strebick was nominally in command. Being smart, she delegated most of the details to Jates as the acting platoon sergeant. Dave wanted to suggest that Strebick's boyfriend sort out the mess upstairs so the UN Navy destroyers could provide close space support. He knew that was unfair. He knew the resentment he felt that their two pilots had ejected just before the dropship slammed into the riverbank was also unfair. 14 people had died in the crash. If the pilots had not ejected, there would have been two more dead and nothing gained by it. He knew his anger should be directed at the enemy, or at the bad intel that had failed to detect a freaking fleet of Theranan ships in the remote star system. If anyone was to blame, it was Skippy the Not Magnificent for missing that fact. Globacus had been selected precisely because it was remote and unimportant, and opposition was known to be light. According to Skippy, that is. The operation should have been easy, at least the landing phase. Instead, what had been a full infantry company of 180 people on the ground was now 40 soldiers, with 8 of those injured badly enough to not be combat effective. 22 had survived from the dropship flown by Strebick, and another 14 had walked away from the crash of Razor 3. There was no sign of the third Scarab. When they had pulled everything useful from the wrecked spacecraft, the group now under Strebick's command set off heading west for lack of a better plan. They needed a better plan. Stranded on a hostile alien world without overhead cover from friendly starships and outnumbered by the enemy, the situation was dire. It also wasn't yet hopeless. They needed a plan to survive, to hang on until the destroyer squadron could establish control of space around the planet, or at least prevent the Theranan from taking control.
Think, Chica. Think, he told himself. There's supposed to be he
eye-clicked to bring up a map overlay in his visor.
A Marine Corps unit around here. Unless they got orders to move out. They should have been outside the impact zone.
United States Marines? Jates asked.
Yeah.
Sometimes it was easy to forget that other countries had Marine units.
Effin' jarheads, someone spat over the platoon channel.
Hey!
Dave turned to glare at the offender.
The way I figure it, Marines are infantry like us.
With his free hand, he tapped the insignia on one shoulder of his mech suit.
That makes them all right to me.
Jates studied his own map.
You want to send out scouts to contact these Marines?
Nah. Dave shook his head. Too risky. We'll try it the old-fashioned way. Kowalski, he called to the soldier who was not a fan of the Marines. Get over here.
Staff Sergeant, come on. You gotta be kidding me.
Kowalski looked up at the tree in dismay.
I'm not a staff sergeant. And do I look like I'm joking?
Dave thumped his faceplate against the hapless soldier's own.
Get your ass up there.
It won't hold my weight in this suit, Kowalski protested.
Then you best strip down, huh?
Clad only in the silky suit liner shirt and pants, plus the mechanical boots and gloves to assist climbing, Kowalski clambered slowly up the alien tree, flinching away as sharp, sticky needles of the pine-like tree scraped against his face.
Shit,
he cursed.
The sap on this thing stings your skin.
You want scented or unscented lotion for your baby's soft skin?
Dave was disgusted.
Move your ass, we haven't got all day.
I'm climbing as fast as I can. I'm not good with heights. That's why I went infantry instead of airborne.
Move!
While Kowalski was slowly nearing the top of the tree, Dave popped the seal on his own helmet, setting it on the ground next to his rifle. Jates cocked his head.
What are you doing, Chica?
getting ready in case he gets stuck up there. Sometimes, Dave unlatched the suit's torso. When you want a job done right, you gotta do it yourself.
This is as high as I can go, Kowalski called from 18 meters up the tree trunk. The branches up here are too small to hold my...
Yeah. Good enough. Dave kept the suit torso on, ready to seal it back up at the first sign of danger. You know what to do. Kowalski took a deep breath, faced toward the southeast, and bellowed as loud as he could into the boom microphone that dangled across his face.
Hey, X-Force! Any Marines out there?
The sound was amplified by a speaker hung around his neck, making him wince. A faint echo of his voice came back, bouncing off a rock slide that exposed the side of a low hill.
Nothing, he called down to the ground. No one is...
Shut up! Dave held up a hand for silence. He did not expect a reply immediately. After 10 seconds, he ordered,
Try the recognition signal.
Echo Golf Romeo 1-9er,
Kowalski sang out, straining his vocal cords, his suit speaker at maximum volume.
Staff Sergeant, I got nothing up here.
Keep trying.
After 5 minutes of repeated calls, Dave removed his own suit with the help of Jates.
What's next? The Big Bird inquired.
Next? Desperate times call for desperate measures, Dave muttered.
All right, Kowalski, you can come down now.
It's harder to climb down than up, the soldier complained.
Jump, and I will catch you, Jates offered, as Dave jumped up to get a grip on the lowest branch of another tree and swung his legs up.
Really?
Kowalski liked the idea of jumping even less than the prospect of feeling his way down with his feet.
No, you dumbass, Jate snorted. Climb down the way you got up there.
Dave quickly realized that what Kowalski said was right. The long, stiff needles of the tree had a sticky sap that made his skin tingle. Taking care not to touch the base where 4 needles came together on the branch helped minimize the amount of sap he accumulated on his face, but it still clung to the gloves. The gecko-like pads of the suit gloves and boots were not hindered by the sap, and pads on the inside of the suit ankles clung to the trunk while he climbed. The tree he had chosen was about the same height as the one Kowalski was in, though it tapered faster, so he had to stop 2 meters lower.
Chaika,
Jates called from below, unseen through the dense tangle of branches that reached up and outward for sunlight.
You think your big mouth is louder than Kowalski's?
No, I just think I got some tricks up my sleeve.
Dave took a series of deep breaths, filling his lungs. Tugging the microphone in front of his mouth, he dialed up the volume and shouted,
The Army won the Battle of Fallujah!
No reply for 1, 2, 3. Then, muffled from far off, a voice called out,
Bullshit!
Dave got down from the tree and immediately wriggled into the torso of his mech suit.
Thanks, he said, as Jates held one of the suit arms. Your Marines are coming? The Verd asked.
Oh, hell yeah, Dave laughed. No way could jarheads ignore something like that.
Hey, he raised his voice.
We should offer the Marines a delicious snack when they get here. Anybody got a box of crayons?
10 minutes later, motion sensors on their suits picked up figures approaching, just as Dave was sealing up his mech suit helmet. Jates kept the platoon behind cover until his helmet received an encrypted signal identifying the figures as belonging to the American 4th Marine Expeditionary Unit, so he cautiously stood up, Chaika beside him. Marines in the lead fanned out when they reached the perimeter of the platoon's defensive line, and a single person strode forward holding a rifle at low ready.
All right, a voice called out. Who's the joker in need of an attitude adjustment?
That would be me.
Dave raised an arm, seeing in his visor that the Marine was a staff sergeant named Kolev.
We'll talk later.
Kolev looked around.
Who's in charge of your outfit?
Dave indicated Jates with a thumb.
Sergeant Jates here is acting platoon sergeant. Our LT didn't make it. Lieutenant Colonel Strebick, he pointed to the senior officer, is in command.
Shit.
Kolev grunted and lowered his voice.
You have a pilot leading this outfit? We lost our lieutenant when those bastard gunships lit us the fuck up. We're down to 22 effective war dogs. You?
He asked hopefully.
32 effective. Dave let out a breath. We had a freaking starship fall on our heads. Dropships pulled some of us out, then we crash-landed here. This is what's left of our company.
Kolev looked around.
Where's your mules?
He used the nickname for the four-legged mechanical cargo haulers that had been added to the Legion's standard list of equipment.
Gone, Dave explained. When we bugged out, we couldn't take anything other than rifles. Our mortar and anti-air teams left their gear behind.
Shit,
the Marine grunted.
We have an anti-air squad, but they're down to four missiles. All our heavy gear was lost when gunships hit our mules. We have two mules left.
He jerked a thumb back over his shoulder.
They're carrying people who can't walk.
Lowering his voice again, he added,
Some of them are in a bad way. You have a medic with you? Our corpsman bought the farm.
We have a medic. Dave frowned, knowing what was left of his platoon was hard-pressed to provide medical care to their own people.
Jates here will get your people sorted.
Seeing Kolev's skeptical look, he explained, Surgeon Grade 3 is equivalent to an E7, making the point that the alien outranked both himself and Kolev in the NATO standard hierarchy adopted by the Legion.
Surgeon.
Kolev nodded to the big Verd Chris.
Jates? Chaika?
Huh. Hey, you guys are...
Mavericks, yeah.
Dave had grown tired of being a celebrity and the expectations that came with it. That, plus not wanting to make themselves a bigger target, was why the Mavericks rarely displayed their unit insignia in the field.
Do you?
Dave's shadow disappeared as a searingly bright light flared above. He hit the ground even before someone shouted down over the platoon channel. With his faceplate gone partially opaque to protect his vision, he kept his eyes tightly closed for a count of 10. Cracking open one eye, he saw his visor flashing a warning, so he counted to 10 again. The warning had faded from red to yellow.
What the hell was that?
He asked around the time others were doing the same. Around him, people were getting to their feet, looking warily at the sky. High in the northwest, there was a bright flickering ball of fire, a new and short-lived sun. Already the light was dimming as streamers arced out and down, chunks of debris burning through the atmosphere. Dave's suit computer calculated the trajectories of the artificial meteors and concluded that while he was within the cone of potential planetfall, nothing of substantial size was expected to strike his position.
Hell, Kolev grunted. That has to be a starship, right?
Yeah. Dave had seen enough ships destroyed by uncontrolled release of jump capacitor energy. The harsh X-rays of the explosion were distinctive. Fortunately, the planet's atmosphere had absorbed most of it even before the high-energy photon struck his armored suit. Question is, theirs or ours? The Navy didn't have much. A voice, distorted by static, broke into the channel.
UNEF forces, this is Captain Duchamp of the Marseille. Scratch one enemy battle wagon.
Whatever the destroyer squadron leader said next was drowned out by cheering, some people punching fists in the air and jumping, forgetting they were in mech suits. The suits had to contain the enthusiasm of their users so no one got hurt. Dave focused on the message, selecting out noise on the channel.
Striking enemy positions as we can. We will feed data to...
There was a burst of static.
We can. Hold out until...
Another burst of static. Dave tried to replay the message, but there wasn't anything he hadn't heard.
There they go.
Jates pointed to the sky where lights twinkled.
Fucking Navy is leaving us,
someone said angrily.
Hey, you! Can that chatter?
Jates barked.
Our destroyers just took out an enemy battleship. They are doing damned well up there.
Looks like they blew up a battleship, a heavy cruiser, and two frigates. Dave read from the data package transmitted by the Marseille as he realized that Jates had referred to the UN Navy ships as ours. He needed to ponder the significance of that. Later.
Opposition is two heavy cruisers now, a pair of DDs,
he used the US Navy designation for destroyers,
and a couple of escorts. That should even out the odds a bit.
Hey, Chaika, Kowalski asked. The Theranin will have to leave orbit now, right? Our tin cans knocked out their battleship.
I don't know, Dave shrugged. Space combat tactics were never something I got into, you know?
He suspected the UN Navy was still working out their tactics.
Surgeon, you see this to the east of us? Across the...
Yes, the Verd confirmed. We're going to have company soon.
Dave studied the map that was part of the data package transmitted by the Marseille. An enemy formation of at least company size was less than 50 kilometers to the east and moving toward the stranded X-Force platoon. The enemy unit was mounted in vehicles, strung out along three more or less parallel routes to avoid making an easy target for an orbital strike.
What is it? Kowalski asked.
Look at grid 337 in the map update. We've got a whole lot of pissed off warrior cast assholes coming this way.
Shit,
Kowalski gulped.
Hey, sir.
Dave had long stopped reminding people not to call him sir.
The Navy will nuke these lizards before they get to us, right? Come on, our Navy just blew a battleship to hell.
I don't know, Kowalski. Maybe our ships just got lucky.
We got lucky.
Derek shook his head on the video conference. The two combat-effective destroyers had been forced to launch their attack before they were fully ready because the enemy had presented a golden opportunity that couldn't be missed. The lone Theranin battleship had been maneuvering to change to a polar orbit, and there was a point where its velocity would be nearly motionless relative to the ground below. Only the massive battle wagon's engines were keeping it from falling, momentarily making it a big, fat target. Derek had feared the Theranin forced their ship into the awkward maneuver to dangle it as bait for the UN ships. If that was the enemy's intention, it had backfired on them spectacularly, with the capital ship falling to the surface in two large and many small pieces. But the UN Navy ships had not escaped the battle unscathed.
I can't disagree with you.
Captain Duchamp of the Marseille tugged at the bandage hanging down over his left eye. His ship had taken a railgun dart that punched through the thin layer of armor plating on the starboard side before ripping through the vulnerable interior and tearing loose three armor panels on the port side on its way out. Ironically, the Marseille had survived because the destroyer's armor was so thin it had not caused the dart to smash itself into a jet of plasma that would have wrecked a large section of the ship. Part of the damage that was caused by the railgun dart and a subsequent particle beam that struck the same area was the rear bulkhead of the bridge being pierced by a chunk of shrapnel. Pieces ricocheting around the bridge were responsible for the gash on Duchamp's forehead, a nasty cut to his left arm, and numerous similar injuries to almost everyone on the bridge. It was a miracle that no one was killed, though three people were in the ship's sickbay, being tended to by doctors and medical machines.
Enemy reaction time is impressive. They've been fighting this war for a long time, Derek noted.
Sir, being lucky isn't a bad thing. We knocked a battleship out of orbit. The Theranin will respect our missile capability now. They know they can't ignore us and do whatever they want above the planet.
That's what worries me, Bunsu. The little green MFers have already adapted to us. They've pulled their ships together in a defensive formation with the two heavy cruisers at the center. The escort ships can saturate the area with overlapping sensor fields that negate the stealth of our fancy missiles, and they can concentrate the point defense cannons against one target at a time.
Jacques, Sao Paulo's captain spoke. That assumes their ships stayed in formation after they engaged stealth. They can't think we're stupid enough to take the bait.
Following the battle, the Theranin ships had moved to protect a cruiser that was suffering intermittent gaps in its stealth field. Or that is what the Theranin wanted the UN force to think.
Jacques, Sao Paulo didn't get a scratch in the last action, he said in a slightly defensive tone.
His destroyer had jumped in at long range and launched missiles before the other two ships in the squadron went in close to launch a furious attack on the battleship. It was all the crippled Sao Paulo could do, and everyone in the squadron knew it.
While the two of you are patching up battle damage, I propose to jump in again. Launch a spread of sensor drones. They can go active. Tell us whether there really are stealth ships around that cruiser or not.
Let me think about that.
Duchamp frowned.
We may want to wait until we're ready for another go. I'd hate to pinpoint the location of the enemy, then have them scramble before we can adjust.
My AI tells me we'll have repaired all the damage we can fix within the hour. Bonsu?
Derek's ship had escaped serious damage in the brief but savage battle.
Shield protectors will be fully recharged in 10 minutes, then we'll be ready to go.
Sir, I agree with Captain Sousa. This might be a good time to poke the enemy with a stick.
Why do you say that?
Right now, we can't take the risk of hitting that cruiser. Like you said, if this becomes a battle of attrition, we lose. If we can force the enemy to change tactics again, we might see an opportunity.
It's worth a try, Sousa prodded. At least we can see if the sensor drones we have work as advertised against the Ranan stealth technology.
Duchamp took a deep breath while he considered.
I understand your point, Emilio.
No, not yet. While we have time, I want to cross deck missiles from Sao Paulo to Marseille and Boston. We'll get that done. Then see if you can flush the quarry.
Those cliffs will be a bitch to climb, Staff Sergeant Kolev noted.
Stretching across their path to the southwest was a ridge 100 meters higher than the surrounding terrain. The north face of the slope was topped by a vertical escarpment that ranged from 10 to 20 meters tall, with the height not being the major problem. Piles of rock at the bottom of the cliff demonstrated how easily the gray rock crumbled. It would be difficult to climb even without the added mass of powered armor.
We should try that,
he instinctively pointed with an arm, though highlighting the area in his visor and sharing the image was more effective.
Pass up there.
Jates knew what the Marine was talking about. There was a gap in the ridge about 3 kilometers to the north where the cliff had tumbled down to fall into the valley below. The map showed that the open ground leading up to and over the pass was littered with large rocks, but a lane had been cleared through the area years ago when the Ruhar were planning to construct a road there. For whatever reason, the road never progressed further than surveying and clearing major obstacles. On the map, the pass looked like the perfect route over the ridge.
Chaika, Jate said to the security contractor, send out drones to scout that pass.
A pair of small, stealthy recon drones zipped away, keeping low over the treetops. The drones were nearly silent, their turbofans buried within the hull and surrounded by sound-canceling material. With the breeze rippling the forest, there was no concern about downdraft from the drones being visible as they disturbed the leaves below. Splitting up as they reached the open grassland a half kilometer from the base of the pass, they dove steeply to hug the ground. The operators set the machines to crisscross the area side to side, weaving back and forth as they rose along the uneven slope of the pass. Up over the top of the pass, they inspected the other side with passive sensors.
Looks clear, one operator said, sending the results to the platoon leadership.
You want us to go active, Sergeant?
Do it, Jates ordered.
Deploying active sensors to scan under the ground would alert any enemy unit within 20 kilometers, letting the enemy know that aliens were somewhere in the vicinity of the pass. Not using active ground-penetrating sensors involved even more risk. The pass could be mined or covered by remote-controlled guns. The enemy knew that what Kolev said was true. The pass was the best route over the ridge. The drones climbed to 20 meters and repeated their outbound flight, crisscrossing as they flew up and over the pass, their active sensors probing 5 or more meters deep into the rocky soil. When the pre-programmed search pattern was complete, the operators set their devices to orbit in lazy circles, waiting for a decision.
Still looks clear.
Kolev replayed the data in his visor, trusting the evidence of his own eyes over the automated search routines of the drones. The drones would have sent an alert if their scanners detected anything hazardous, and they had not found anything that could be threatening. Between the two drones, they had only found a few items that were artificial. 2 were beverage containers, probably discarded by the road construction crews. The other items were tiny scattered fragments of cellulose fibers that littered the area just under the surface. Dave was also replaying the sensor data.
Jates, Kolev, look at this.
He highlighted sections of the map and sent it to the others.
See how the soil is compacted here in circles here and here? There are more sites like this farther up the pass.
I see it, Kolev muttered.
There were a half dozen round marks under the soil, several meters down.
So? Probably the road-building equipment tamped down the soil.
Yeah, could be. But you can see the tracks of their vehicles.
Dave highlighted strips of ground where something heavy had rolled over through the pass. The double set of tracks were faint, barely visible, except where the composition of the soil made it less able to bounce back from being compressed. These circles go up onto the sides of the pass, see? Whatever equipment that rolled through there stayed in the middle. And, he enhanced the image, there's something in the middle of each circle. It looks like, I don't know what it is, something soft? Huh. The scan says it's wood. That can't be right.
Old tree stumps, Kolev guessed.
Tree stumps that are all almost exactly 70 centimeters in diameter?
What are you saying, Chaika?
Jates was growing impatient. I'm saying that these circles look a lot like impact sites. Like somebody used inert rounds to sight in their artillery, you know? He could not imagine why the impact sites had lumps of wood in the center. Unless...
Shit!
Kolev grunted, taking another look at the pattern of circles. They were not regularly spaced, but they walked up and over the pass.
You could be right. The shells would still be buried in the soil, Jates objected. Not if they policed the area, Kolev noted. That's the perfect shit job for a group of Marines who need incentive training. Huh. They could have filled in the craters, but the soil underneath would still be compacted. Yeah.
He warmed to the idea.
Those fragments the drone saw, the cellulose fiber stuck in the dirt, kinda shallow? That could be from testing an airburst, anti-personnel weapon.
Cellulose? Dave would have scratched his head if he weren't wearing a helmet.
That is wood, right? Wood or cardboard, Kolev nodded. A nice biodegradable material if you want to simulate a shrapnel weapon without having to police a couple thousand fragments. Those tree stumps? Maybe they made the inert rounds out of cellulose fibers also. Huh. Pretty smart. Lightweight. Saves having to lug around a lot of useless mass, and they could just leave them in the ground to decay.
Dave's face turned white at the thought of hardened ceramic shrapnel replacing the cellulose slugs.
Shit. That's a pure choke point. I bet every piece of artillery the enemy owns is in range and ready to blow us to shit,
Kolev concluded.
Chaika, you're pretty smart for an army puke. Sergeant, we should reconsider. Try another route.
Jates ground his teeth while he thought.
We do not know whether there is any artillery in this sector.
I know one way of finding out, Dave snorted. We know from Fresno that the Kristang love to use artillery. Kowalski had inched closer while the three were talking, having missed the first part of the discussion.
Hey, Sergeant, we're not climbing those cliffs, are we? Why can't we just take that pass?
Dave shook his head.
Because it... No, Jates interrupted. By all means, lead the way, Kowalski.
He pointed to the road that led through a gap in the mountain ridge.
Really?
The soldier was instantly wary, feeling that he had unwittingly volunteered for something.
Yes. Jates loomed over the hapless soldier and growled. We can use your burning corpse to mark the engagement zone.
Shit.
Kowalski gulped as Kolev and Chaika laughed.
Maybe I'll just...
He backed away.
You know, wait for orders.
A wise decision, Jates growled,
just as Lieutenant Colonel Strebik called.
Sergeant, what's the holdup? We need to keep moving.
Dave touched the Verd's forearm.
Starbuck is cool, man.
He used the pilot's call sign given to her because many people didn't know how to pronounce her surname. Dave knew the experienced sergeant was irritated by having to answer questions from an officer who knew nothing about ground combat.
Just talk to her. I know that, Chaika.
Switching to the platoon command channel, he explained,
There is a good chance the enemy has artillery sighted in on that gap in the ridge.
I don't like the sound of that. What are our...
She paused as mortar fire sounded in the distance with a muffled crump.
Options.
That morning, the platoon had successfully broken contact with the enemy squad that pursued them all the previous night.
The ridge is lower, beginning 15 kilometers to the south.
The pilot didn't reply immediately. It is also lower only 9 clicks to the north.
Yes, ma'am, but there is a bridge across the river to the north. If the enemy is bringing in reinforcements, they will come from that direction.
I see it. South, then. Let's get moving before my legs get stiff again.
This is a no-go, Duchamp declared when data was received from the sensor probes launched by Sao Paulo.
The probes had flown in stealth to surround the enemy cruiser that was supposedly experiencing difficulty with its stealth field generators. Coasting into range of the enemy sensor fields, the probes dropped stealth and sent out their own powerful active sensor pulses, revealing the presence of 6 other enemy ships, including the other heavy cruiser. The other ships were positioned in a globe formation, with the heavy cruiser acting as bait in the center.
Good thinking, Emilio, he praised the captain of the Sao Paulo. The Turanen set up an ambush for us. If we jump in again to take the bait, they will trap us in damping fields. Our AI estimates the damage to Marseille will take 16 hours to repair, and 1/3 of our shield projectors will be disconnected during the work. That leaves us with only Boston as fully combat effective.
I hate to add more bad news, but Captain Souza shared a display of the battle damage to his own ship. My ship has to take another reactor offline. After that, we can only make 2 jumps without eating into our safety margin.
Merde, Duchamp cursed.
In that case, Emilio, I'd like to designate Sao Paulo as a stores ship and rotate crews as needed.
As needed for what? Souza raised an eyebrow.
That is a good question. Duchamp bit his lower lip.
We don't need to win a fight, Souza suggested. We only need to create a contested environment.
The squadron commander grunted.
He knew the theory developed by SPAWAR, the UN Navy's Space Warfare Command. That unit was responsible for researching and recommending strategy, tactics, and doctrine to the UN Navy. Most of their policy documents were based on the experience of the Ruhar and Jarraptha, who had been fighting the war for a very long time. The entry of a new player in the conflict did not change the basic facts or physics, even though the UN ships generally had capabilities the Jarraptha could only dream about. SPAWAR mostly focused on ship-to-ship action, but they had coordinated with the Expeditionary Force to determine how starships could and should support units dirtside. To know how he could offer protection and fire support to the people on the ground, Duchamp had to understand the tactics of ground pounders. People who fought inside mech suits rather than inside a starship that massed thousands of tons. The X-Force, both from their own experience on Paradise and from setting boots on multiple worlds with the Alien Legion, agreed with every alien civilization across the galaxy on how best to deploy ground troops. With the threat of orbital bombardment literally hanging over their heads, the largest unit that could be gathered together was a platoon. Anywhere from 30 to 70 troops, depending on whether the base rifle squads were supplemented by heavy weapons and anti-air squads. Larger units, such as companies and battalions, existed almost purely for administrative and command and control purposes. Platoons rarely fought in company formation. The reason was math that could not be argued with. A company, consisting of over 100 soldiers, provided a tempting target for an orbital strike. A platoon, especially when equipped with chameleon wear on individual mech suits and with portable stealth field generators carried by mules, often presented a slippery target for a starship. Ground units on the offensive mostly focused on identifying the location of enemy units so they could be hit by indirect fire rather than engaging directly with rifles. Orbital bombardment by starships, even when conducted by line-of-sight weapons like railguns and masers, were still classed as indirect fire for want of a better term. Ground units fighting on defense tried to avoid being herded into concentrations large enough to be deemed shipworthy, meaning a target on the ground that was worth risking a starship to hit it. That was what Captain Souza meant when he said the UN destroyer squadron did not need to defeat the Theranin force. The 3 ships under Duchamp's command only needed to create a contested environment. a situation where the enemy commander had to consider whether an orbital strike was worth the risk to ships that were somewhat vulnerable in low orbit. If the Thorana knew the UN squadron had been chased away, their ships could spread out to cover the planet and leisurely fire their maser cannons at targets as small as a single squad of humans. But if the Thoranan had to worry about attacks by the human starships, they had to remain in a defensive formation and in stealth, concealing their positions.
I know the theory, Duchamp frowned. The question is, does the enemy think the same way? They may have standing orders to destroy a human force if they have the opportunity, which they certainly have here. We know the Maxolk's coalition is desperate to demonstrate they can contain us. My counterpart might be willing to lose every ship he has just to save face. My point is, contesting the battle space here is a risk, and it will only be worth the risk if the enemy cooperates. No, he shook his head. He was responsible for the lives aboard the three ships of the squadron. We can keep their attention with minimal risk by Boston jumping in at a safe distance and jumping away. Let them know we are still here.
Where would we go? Sousa asked, skeptical.
Jacques, are you suggesting we are a fleet in being?
He referenced the old strategy of a fleet of warships being a threat and constricting the enemy's range of options, even if the fleet wasn't doing anything. Just by existing and presenting a potential threat, the fleet could disrupt enemy plans.
That only works if the Thoranan view us as a continuing threat. I'm suggesting, Duchamp glared, annoyed, that we don't have many options, and even fewer good options.
Bonsu, when can you move out?
Soon as we program a jump, sir, Derek answered.
I am sending you a course.
Duchamp looked down as he typed in commands.
Now, execute when you're ready.
Moments after the conference call ended, Derek was interrupted by a call from the Sao Paulo.
Captain Sousa?
Is there anything you need from me?
Right now, Derek said. Your offer to rotate crews might become necessary depending on how long we're at action stations. My people need to stay sharp if we're going to stay useful.
Speaking of being useful,
Sousa lowered his voice, though they were both alone in their offices.
You see the problem with Duchamp's plan?
I do. The enemy also makes plans. Waving a red flag in front of the Thoranan will get their attention for a while, but they want a battle here. I'm afraid they will do something to force us to react to them.